Welcome to episode 314 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Ash Baker,
Juliana Ramsey.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be concluding, bringing to an end our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1988's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. But real quick, some housekeeping notes. For those who are longtime listeners of the podcast, or you like our writing or our video essays, what have you, we are going to be doing a special live watch party. This is going to be something that in the future will be exclusively for our Patreon supporters. So as we, you know, say every episode, please support us on Patreon. But we're going to do the first one open to everybody at cinematary.com. So we're going to be watching Snowpiercer, the 2013 film by Bong Joon-ho, who, if you're not, you know, privy to him, he is the Oscar-winning director of Parasite. So if you've seen Parasite but have not seen any of his other movies, this is a good one to check out. This is kind of one of his big, first big hits in America. It stars Chris Evans. So, you know, Captain America. But it's on Netflix, so we're going to be doing a Netflix party. And we'll be watching it on Sunday at 7 p.m. So if you're listening to this on Friday or Saturday, specifically the Friday that this drops, on Sunday, we will be, Sunday at 7 p.m., we will be watching Snowpiercer. So go to cinematary.com/watchparty, cinematary.com/watchparty. It's up there on the homepage. It gives you all the instructions. So if you're like, I don't know what a Netflix party is, and I don't know what a Discord is, and all of that kind of stuff, Andrew has a nice little handy guide for you. And then, like I said, join us on Patreon, patreon.com/cinematary, and support the show. And we will be doing these monthly. So come watch Snowpiercer with us. It's going to be a good time. You'll get to hear commentary. I don't really know what I'm going to talk about through the entire movie, but because I really don't talk during movies, but I guess we're going to just figure it out. So, all right, well, let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. And our theme for part one is going to be girly movies. I think our theme for part two will be girly movies, too, to an extent. Ash, you
have... Ladies episode.
You have three that you're going to talk about. The first one, as I told you before we started recording, it seems like everybody on Cinematary has to talk about it. So tell us a little bit about your impressions of Down with Love.
Yeah, so I have been on a journey of watching girly movies, girl power movies. I have started with these that I'm going to begin... or these that I'm going to talk about. Down with Love was fucking awesome. Down with Love, it's from 2003, and it stars Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger, that person. But anyway,
what is she from? Bridget Jones's Baby Diary, something.
What other big Jones's movie was diary. She from? Big, from a Baby Diary. It's like a small, diary that she carries around.
A little diary.
Oh, she's in Chicago. She's in the movie adaptation of Chicago. Yeah. She plays
Roxy. I feel
Roxy.
Like she's in a lot of, like, girl power movies, so, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's about a woman named Barbara Novak, who has written this book called Down with Love, and it's about how... women should say no to love and, just go through, and focus on their career, and they can, still have sex with men, but just in the same ways that men have sex with women, just purely for pleasure, a la carte, and just don't fall in love, because that is what traps a woman and keeps her behind in the world. And this was her, like, great feminist plan for women to become equals in the workforce and in the world. And so, of course, she, like, faces problems trying to get it published in a mail-run publishing world. But she has some help, and eventually basically, she is sort of in a rivalry with the lead writer of a men's magazine called No, Catcher Block, who's played by Ewan McGregor. And he's, of course, a New York playboy, just the epitome of everything that she hates in a man. And it's sort of a, I want to say a classic screwball comedy, but the way that it plays out sort of, it sort of flips the genre, or I don't know if you'd call it a genre, but sort of the structure and the conventions of a screwball comedy, it sort of flips those conventions on its head as it sort of plays out. So it's like a really fresh take on a screwball comedy, as well as just being like really hilarious. And it's set in the, it's set in the 60s, the early 60s. So all the outfits are wild and colorful, and the tone of it is really like upbeat and like, it's really like theatrical in a way. Like, there was a moment early on in the movie, I was like, are they going to burst out into song? Because it kind of had this like really upbeat tone of a musical, but it is not a musical, but it's a whole lot of fun, and it's really, really funny. And it's also like sort of everything that you want in like both a romance movie, but a romance movie that like doesn't just like bend over for the romance plot. It's like about, you know, like women not sacrificing themselves for men, and that plot itself is not sacrificed in a lot of, in the way that like a lot of stories, both movies and books and otherwise, like do sacrifice that sort of like narrative. So it's like really good.
Yeah. Is it, how did you watch it?
quickly.
Carefully. I watched it on the good old internet.
I might just have to take a tour to the old internet and watch it, because...
Yeah, it sounds fun.
Yeah, dig deep. You'll find it. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I would highly recommend it for anyone who's just up for a good old time.
I need to watch more movies that are just a good old time. No more depressing movies this year.
It's a lot of fun. The outfits are just like... just super great. Like, some great costumes. It's a very colorful movie. Very good.
It has like a... is it set in the 50s, or it kind of has like a 50s like vibe or whatever?
It's early 60s. So yeah, it's sort of like still on the tail end of like the 50s. It's like, you know, sort of like the Jackie Kennedy like pillbox hats, yeah, and stuff like that.
It's you describing the outfits kind of reminds me of, I think it's from 98 or 99, but Dick, that takes place. Is that in the 60s? I guess it's the 70s.
It's in the 70s, yeah.
But also just so good, the outfits, like very colorful and over the top. So maybe a little double feature.
Oh yeah, that would be a great double feature with this one.
Andrew is listening and shaking his head in agreement.
Definitely. Another movie on my girly movie excursion, actually the first one, I am ashamed as a East Tennessean to say that I had not watched this until recently, but I watched 9 to 5. I think I put it off for so long because I knew that it was sort of like the Dolly movie. And I guess I just like didn't want to be disappointed by it. And I certainly was not. I thought
Boy, does that movie not disappoint.
No, it did not disappoint. It was really epic. Super funny, but also like super poignant. And I really loved the sort of like the sentiment of, oh, well, if your company won't let you unionize, just literally kidnap your boss. And then you can, you know, make all the changes while you've got him tied up. Because literally, I think right now a lot of, I don't know, I've been working with a union in Kentucky, and I think right now people are really agitated, and it's a really great time for people to be unionizing because so many people are out of work, so many people are getting, I don't know, I feel like work problems are just at their breaking point right now because of the pandemic and because of like all of the unrest surrounding police brutality and the election coming up in November. And I feel like that's just sort of like about to explode in the workplace. And so I feel like unionization is like, not to just like fully go political on the podcast, but I feel like unionization is like something that is like an actual tangible way for people to make real change in their communities right now when it feels like there's nothing we can do. And so it was just really kind of nice to watch a movie with like my hometown hero that was like kind of, you know, it wasn't like Norma Rae where it was like literally like, let's stand up on the table and unionize. But it was like, okay, you won't let us unionize. Well, we'll show you how kind of absurd that is. That you have stripped us of our, like, most, like, basic right, you know, which is to say that we want, like, a better workplace. So, yeah, fucking love 9 to 5. Really, really great.
Yeah, I mean, it's like...
What's your...
It's like when...
I was gonna say, what's your Dolly review?
Okay. Two questions. Juliana, what was your question?
Oh, no, I was going to say, it's sort of like when everything in real life is so difficult with finding work and wanting to unionize, and that's, you know, it's so much simpler just to watch, you know, like Dolly Parton and Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda just do exactly what you want to do instead of having to do things, you know, the right way and the hard way and the long way.
Exactly, exactly. And to answer your question, Zach, my Dolly review is 5 stars, 10 out of 10. She's absolutely amazing. I just, like, I love her. I mean, I've always loved her, but, like, to see her in a role like this, you know, playing out a character that was, like, just, like, so, like, sweet, but also, like, strong and, like... Not only that, but I feel like it's so rare to see someone on screen in like such a huge movie and who just sounds like they're from where I'm from, which is like is such a like simple thing, but it is just like really it was really powerful to me to just like hear Dolly talk in this movie and like say, like one time she just said like a little like offhand joke that like wasn't, you know, wasn't like a big punchline. It was just like a little snitty side remark, but it was just like, it was something that was so familiar to me. It was something that like my grandmother or my great aunt would say. And I was like, oh my God, like I love Dolly so much. I'm so glad that, you know, she's, you know, my town's claim to fame and not some fucking poser.
Yeah. No, the movie.
Yeah, you said it.
It's the best.
Yeah. And then very briefly, the last movie that I've watched recently off my girly list is Legally Blonde. Ooh. This was another one that I had put off forever, not for any other reason.
You've never seen it?
I'd never seen Legally Blonde.
Oh my God.
I put it off all this time for no other reason than it has a lot of pink in it, and I'm just that butch. and so I watched Legally Blonde, and you know what? It is a good movie. It is really good. It was just like a very nice movie. Reese Witherspoon's character, I mean, obviously her performance was incredible, but her character is just such a, like a sweet, nice person. And I would, you know, without going too in depth, I would just like to say that all three of these movies have like men in power asking women to get them coffee as sort of like a thing that the women are irritated about. And it was just something I noticed. Men like to ask women to get them coffee.
Apparently.
That's it.
That's the main takeaway from all these movies. That was the whole point of them.
Yeah. That's the biggest one. Don't ask me to get your coffee, dudes.
Let's get now available at the Cinematary shop. Everybody, you can buy the Ash Baker shirt, which is "Don't ask me to get coffee, you dudes." Juliana, to keep with the girly movies part one, take us home with quite honestly a shocking entry from you, because I don't remember there being any vampires in Happy Go Lucky.
No vampires in this one. I'm breaking from my brand, and so early in my only like third or fourth podcast episode, but yeah, Happy Go Lucky. I watched it as part of, it's one of the movies leaving the Criterion Channel at the end of this month. So I was like, let me just go ahead and watch that one. It's my first Mike Lee movie. That's the director. And I have a bunch of his stuff on my list. But yeah, this is a little bit different from what I would normally watch, because I am like a horror, drama, depressing, blood and guts vampire movie type of person.
Definitely Mike Lee's movies.
Yeah, no, see, that's the thing, is I was like, okay, well, I'm definitely gonna have to watch some stuff by him, but I don't know, I was just sort of in a campy, this movie's not campy, but like, I also like fun movies sometimes. but this one is, it takes place in London and following a super hyper positive, really sweet, like elementary school teacher named Poppy, who is played by Sally Hawkins, AKA Paddington's mom. that's how I know her. It was just really phenomenal. I mean, I think a lot of times when there are movies that have like a very positive, like bubbly female lead, they're very like one-dimensional, or they're comedies, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but this movie is so nice just because like her performance, like it just felt like supernatural. Like she was just genuinely this happy person, and it doesn't show her in a way where it's just like this is the only thing about her. The movie just really explores like other people's reactions to her positivity and like how she also reacts in turn. So it just gives like this very like nuanced look at this person, And so, yeah, it was really great. A lot of the, I think, subplots of the movie deal with, like, how people deal with their own, like, anger. And so I feel like having the main character being this person that doesn't really get... She doesn't really get angry because she's just so relentlessly positive. And sort of, like, how she interacts with them. It was just, like, so good. And now I have to watch... like all of his other movies.
Yeah, I don't know if they're all this bubbly and poppy, though. I'm going to be honest with you.
Oh, no. But, you know, I watch some crazy stuff, too.
All right. Because I was going to say, I recently watched one of his movies, All or Nothing, and it has Timothy Spall is in it because he's in a lot of his movies. It has Leslie Manville, who people might know from Phantom Thread, who plays the sister character. And then it also has a young James Corden in like a pitch perfect like role for him because he's like this super angry, overweight, like probably like in his early 20s, and is just completely just an asshole the entire time. which I feel like is just James Corden in real life. And then Sally Hawkins has like a small role in it as well, but it's just, they're kind of, I can see like why, some people probably don't go along with them because like that one, it's a pretty like simple, straightforward story. And you have like these working class London, you know, working class characters in London who, are just kind of trying to like make ends meet, and those ends are generally not meeting. And so it's not like, at least it wasn't like an incredibly like difficult watch, you know, it wasn't something where it was like, oh, I just, you know, got to make through it. But, it's like, you're stuck in like these narratives with these, characters who you're, you know, relatively empathetic to, but also just kind of do frustrating things. And it's like a frustrating 2 hours.
Oh yeah. Well, a lot of it is like the characters, like the main characters, Poppy is a school teacher. And then like several of their friends are as well. And then there's like a tango instructor and the, she's taking like driving lessons throughout the movie is one of the subplots. And yeah, there's like not a lot of like, the plot doesn't really like go anywhere really. Like there's like a character arc, you know, for everybody in it, but it's not like a super driven thing. She's just like, yeah, I'm 30, I live with my best friend, I'm a school teacher, and I love my life. Like this is just me living, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. Is Timothy Spall the isn't he the driver? The driving instructor?
No,
it's Eddie Marson. I take it back. Cool. Well, you know, I recommend that one as well. Happy Go Lucky's great.
Yeah,
and I think it's
really sweet.
Yeah. So if you can check it out, please do. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back talking women on the verge of a nervous breakdown after this.
Hey, Cinematary listeners. Andrew here. During this break in the show, I'd like to mention that Cinematary does want your money. You can give us your money at patreon.com/cinematary, where you can chip in a small fee of about $5 a month, you know, the price of a fancy coffee, in exchange for shout outs in every episode, the opportunity to choose movies we cover on the show, and bonus episodes every month in which we talk about more movies as well as other miscellaneous stuff. In the past, we've just been humbly asking for you to share the show and engage with us, and we would still love for you to do those things. You can tweet us at Cinematary, send us an email, zach@cinematary.com, leave us a review on iTunes, all that stuff. But Cemetery has grown a ton in the past few years due to the hard work of a bunch of writers, myself included, who haven't been paid for their labor, which is sadly a pretty normal thing. We record things and write things for free, you listen to and read them for free, and the only people getting paid are like Apple and Google, which is depressing. So, if you appreciate what we do, if you feel like there's some sort of value being exchanged here and you'd like more of it, help us normalize paying people by going to patreon.com/cinematary and chipping in $5 a month. We would truly appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the show.
Igual que en una escena. necesario. Ya conozco ese teatro, mintiendo, qué bien te queda el papel. Después de todo parece que esa es tu forma de ser. Yo confiaba ciegamente en la fiebre de tus besos.
And we're back with part two of episode 314 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be concluding our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1988's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. It is written and directed by Pedro Almodovar, which is our first of his that we've done on the podcast. And the film stars Carmen Mora, Antonio Banderas, Julieta Serrano, Rosy De Palma, and Maria Barranco. When Pepa Marcos' lover Ivan suddenly leaves her without any explanation, she embarks on a strange journey to discover why. On the way, she meets a variety of eccentric characters, including Ivan's son from a previous relationship, his fiancée Marissa, and a Shiite terrorist cell who has been secretly holding her best friend Candela hostage. In an interview with The Guardian in 2016, Almodovar said the film came from his own experiences at the time. Quote, although it's not biographical, my films do reflect whatever I was going through at the time. Back then, I would come through the door, and if the answering machine was blinking, I was happy. If there was nothing, I felt a terrible uncertainty. I was trying to talk about abandonment, about misunderstanding between men and women. The idea came from The Human Voice, a play by Jean Cocteau from 1930, but in a very free way. I often start writing with an idea of my own or someone else's, and in the process discover something else I really want to write. The first idea disappears, but it has an important place because it's the thing that pushed you. On the lasting impact of the film, he said, quote, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown is a key film in my life. It went all over the world and opened up doors for me. There have been two musical adaptations and an Italian theater version. It's a film that is very much alive. Actress Rosy De Palma told The Guardian that the experience of playing Marissa was different than any of her other roles. Quote, he wrote the part of Marissa for me in the movie. It felt more like being an actor because unlike in Law of Desire, my character had nothing to do with my real life. She did not dress like me. Marissa, who comes to Peppa's apartment with her boyfriend, who happens to be Peppa's lover's son, drinks gazpacho filled with sleeping pills and falls asleep. At the beginning, I was like, my goodness, I'm not doing anything here. One day, I was told I had to come to the set because they needed to film my legs on a sun lounger as the camera panned across Peppa's terrace. I have to go just lie down, I thought. This is the role of an actress? I was very heavy with Pedro, always saying, I'm bored. He would say, what are you going to do? When people are asleep, they're asleep. Eventually, he said, okay, you're going to have a dream and you're going to have an orgasm. Then you won't be a virgin anymore as a dream is going to be so real for you. I said, I'll take it. Like I said, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown has been adapted into a musical by Jeffrey Lane and David Yazbek. The production opened on Broadway in November of 2010. And the cast included Patti LuPone, Sherry Renee Scott, Laura Benanti, and Brian Stokes Mitchell. And the production was a limited engagement that was scheduled to end in January 2011, but due to low grosses and ticket sales, it closed early in January. At the time of the closing, the show had played 30 previews and 69 regular performances. In 1988, the New York Times said, Women on the Verge takes place in its own very special farcical universe, where outrageous coincidences are the norm and where logic dictates that a forgotten blender full of spiked gazpacho will be drunk by a woman by the wrong person. It's also a place where a TV anchor is a sweet old grandmother instead of a barely literate sex symbol, and where Peppa, an actress, appears in a commercial for a detergent guaranteed to get the blood out of your killer son's shirt and trousers. Though feminist in its sympathies, Women on the Verge is far from being a tract of any sort. The characters Mr. Almodovar has written and directed keep asserting idiosyncrasies that do not allow them or the film to be so humorlessly categorized. And the Washington Post in 1988 said, Spain's prolific Pedro Almodovar leaves black comedy behind in his fabulous 50s-ish caprice, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. In this glossy delight, it's as if Doris Day had been brought forward in time and confronted with the consequences of living in sin. So, on that note, let's talk a little bit about Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. this is not the first Almodovar that I've seen. I actually really have not seen too many of his. I really enjoyed his film from last year, Pain and Glory. But I'm like we kind of talked about at the end of the podcast last week, I've not seen, I'm very, unfamiliar with a large part of his work. And so this kind of felt like the perfect, even though I'd seen a couple before, this seemed like a good entry point into him. It was really enjoyable. Juliana, what did you think of the film?
Yeah. I haven't seen any of his other work before either. So this is my first experience. And I really enjoyed it. It's sort of humorous and dramatic, and it is one of those things where it is like its own kind of world. Right after I finished watching it, I realized that it kind of reminded me of the like Clue movie, where it's a lot of like very particular characters, like sort of in this apartment, like running around and investigating stuff, and things are happening, and it's like kind of funny. Well, that sounds, It was humorous, but like it has more to it than that. And also, I had to reckon with the fact that I don't know what gazpacho is. I thought she was just making tomato juice, but then in one of the like final scenes where she's like saying what's in the gazpacho, I was like, garlic, onions, bell pepper. I've heard this word before, and I never realized that that's what was in it.
I kept thinking of, for fans of the TV show I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson, I was thinking of the skit where Tim Heidecker is this obnoxious guy at a party and he keeps asking for his gazpacho. But I really don't know. I don't think I've ever had gazpacho. It's funny though, because I mean, I could see where your confusion comes from, because we see her like cutting up the tomatoes and then putting it into the blender. But then, yeah, she's like listing all the other ingredients, and we never see that part. It looks like she just cut up tomatoes and then blended them and then started drinking it. So,
yeah, it looks like she, I don't know. At first, like, I assumed she was making salsa or something, and then she just like drinks it, and I was like, oh my God, it sounds like the most disgusting drink of all time.
It's not something that you know, when the police and everybody is at your house, you're like, hey, you guys want some gazpacho?
You want some salsa to drink?
Ash, what did you, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I feel like that's like one of the, there are like several like objects throughout the film that just like, you're like, oh, of course it keeps coming up, like the crazy cab, and then the picture, like when the fiance goes to like open the fridge and you see the picture, you're like, oh, of course. And so I thought that was like kind of a fun device.
Absolutely. Ash, what did you make of the movie?
I thought it was fucking crazy. I was actually by the end of it like really feeling anxious. There was just like so much crazy shit that happened, and people were just acting so crazy throughout the whole thing. I was like, it was like, I don't know, it was just like, you could understand like the way that, I'm blanking on her name, the friend with the good hair, who reminded me of Shelley Duvall.
Candela.
Oh,
I think it's Candela.
Yeah. Candela, you could completely understand sort of how she was feeling because of like what was going, like her sort of like backstory and what was going on with her. But like the main character was just being such an asshole to her the entire time. She's like calling her and she's like, I'm really in trouble, I need your help.
Oh yeah.
She's like, you're being such a pain, don't you know I have a life? Like, and you're just like, why is she acting this way? And after a while you're just like, wow, she's actually just a very mean person or something. You know, at first you're like, oh well, she's having a bad day, you know, the love of her life left her, whatever. But then after a while, you're like, wow, like, she just is really like that, you know? And that was like sort of distressing to me. I don't know. I feel like whenever I'm put in the position of there's a protagonist who, I guess I anticipate that I'm going to have to sympathize with, and I actually just end up like not liking them. It's like puts me in an awkward position because like, of course we don't have to like characters, and we don't have to think characters are good people, but, it's just like sort of a weird thing when you don't know where to place your sympathy, I guess. And so that was sort of the thing for me in this movie, because I was like, who can I, that was sort of the game I was playing it, watching this movie, because you have this whole cast of characters, who are all like a little kooky, and, you're like, okay, who can I sympathize with? Basically, it, at least is how I was feeling as I was watching it. And, it was really interesting to see like how it changed throughout the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think though that like, cause pretty much all of the characters are just like these kind of absurd, almost like caricature like people, because going back to a point that Juliana made, it very much like is inhabiting its own like world. That's kind of what I loved about it. Like it honestly, it took me a while to get into the movie. It's kind of, it's not necessarily slow at the beginning, but if you don't really know, like, I mean, just like the beginning of the movie compare in like when she's like kind of, you know, chasing, you know, Yvonne, like around like trying to figure out where he is. And then just the whole second half of the movie where everybody's in the apartment are like just kind of two different energies. And I really love that second half. but it's like, it's something I've talked about on the podcast before. It's like, it's just like a movie that completely knows, that's like completely comfortable with what it's trying to do. Like it fully knows like this is, like all, there's no, like you could say it's an illogical movie, or I mean I get that it's a farce, but like it's, you could say, well, this doesn't make, you know, this doesn't make any sense, like, you know, with the gazpacho and all the different points that come up, but like within the context of like the movie, like within the context of the narrative, it makes complete sense that like all that stuff is happening and that all of these characters are just kind of crazily absurd. It reminded me a little bit of like a John Waters movie where there's like enough reality to kind of base you so you don't feel completely out of, you know, like you're swimming out by yourself, but at the same time it just has like this completely like streamlined understanding of like the insanity that all of these people, like all of the different characters have. I mean, like, I think it really came to head for me when the lady is on the back of the motorcycle with the pistol and they're like chasing her with the, and she's just like shooting at the taxi.
Crazy.
I mean, it's just like an absurd movie, and but it like from start to finish knows it's absurd. And I love movies that are able to kind of do that and are very like it knows exactly what its logic is. So I very much enjoyed this a lot just because I felt like, you know, especially as stuff, you know, as the kind of the rock is rolling down the hill for the second half, like every moment is incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, I feel like when I first started watching the movie, like the opening shot is the apartment building, but it's a miniature, and it just is sort of like, what? And then also like at the very beginning where she's at work and they're doing the like overdubs of like the TV or the movies or whatever. It just immediately kind of was like, hey, there's something kind of weird and artificial here. Like, it's kind of in its own little, like, space. It's not trying to be, you know, realistic in any way. And yeah, the, like, whole motorcycle chase scene and her two guns was very, like, John Waters-y. But yeah, I feel like throughout the movie, it was, like, there were plot points that were, like, over-exaggerated and under-exaggerated. Like, when the friend tries to jump off the balcony and they're just like, they're like, oh, this is horrible, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, 5 minutes later, the main character's like, okay, well, I'm gonna head out of here. You seem better or whatever. Make sure she doesn't try to jump again, and then runs off, you know?
Yeah. It's, I think you used a good word to describe it. It's artificial. Like, it does feel like, I think Almodovar is a director who's very particular on, like, when things are happening. Like, he seems to be, like, a very hands-on director with, like, I want this specific thing to be happening, because he very much has, like, this singular vision in his mind. And, you know, sometimes that can become, you know, overbearing. I know that a lot of people say there's some, you know, there's a string of his movies that just don't really come together or coalesce. But this one, I feel like, it completely just seeps you into, like, that, just the insanity of this world. Like, just the main character herself. I mean, Ash, you were talking about, like, how incredibly rude she is. Like, you kind of empathize with her to a extent, just because she seems like she's sad and lonely. But at the same time, like, she just has, like, such a bombastic personality and will just kind of, you know, shoot from one side to the next. You know, they talk about the older lady character who's like the first wife or whatever of Yvonne, who is the mother of the Antonio Banderas character. He keeps mentioning that she's like mentally ill, and I was kind of like, I feel like everybody on screen right now is, you know, somewhat mentally ill, like all of these characters, because they're all like legitimately insane in some way.
Also, just Antonio Banderas, who I thought was going to be in the movie a lot more, but basically he just kind of stood in the back and looked pretty and smooched.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe the only one who was not a little bit off their rocker was the fiance, although she was, like, terribly rude. But she basically spent the entire movie asleep. Until the very end. And I love the scene where she's like having a sex dream, and they're like, what's happening to her? And what's her name? The friend is like, she's having a wonderful time, can't you see? And Antonio Banderas is like, I've never seen her like this before. which I thought was just epic, because you could tell that Antonio Banderas was just, like, obviously terribly horny, but that he had never really pleasured her. So, yeah, great character. Antonio Banderas' hair was very Johnny Bravo in this. Very tall.
Very long. Well, not long, but very... horizontal, I guess.
It was like, I feel like tall, long, and horizontal are all accurate in a weird way.
We should describe his hair a little bit more. I don't think we're getting it across.
it was like Johnny Bravo. It was like pointing forward. It was like pointing. His hair was like pointing forward off of his head.
We were just fixating on this one thing.
And it was like defying gravity.
This isn't about the hair, but like, and then he has like his outfit. He has like the shirt that's like too big for him, that he like does.
I love
that
he
does like a kind of like a French tuck type thing on.
Oh yeah.
It's just,
he's got that Stop Making Sense outfit on.
Yeah. It's just it's a whole look.
Yeah, love his outfit and the glasses. Yeah, he definitely has a look in this movie.
The friend's little coffee earrings. I mean, I feel like, yes, just the outfits were so good. Like, they all just kind of made sense for the characters. And they were just, you know, wonderfully 80s.
Yeah, the mocha pot earrings were great.
One thing I kept coming across, just, you know, doing some cursory research of the movie and reading a little bit about it, is a lot of people have kind of hailed it as like this, somewhat of like a feminist movie. They mentioned it a little bit in the New York Times review, but just in terms of like looking at it as like a feminist movie, was that something that stuck out to either of y'all while watching it?
Well, we have the feminist as a character, which I thought was really funny. There's like one woman that they're all like, oh yeah, she's the feminist. And she's, of course, spoiler, the one who is stealing that man. Which, I don't know, it's interesting because it's like, it's sort of like, Zach, your review of 9 to 5 is like, I guess the title Men Ain't Shit, the movie wasn't as catchy, but I kind of feel like that could also be the title of this movie. I feel like they just spend the entire movie like shitting on this guy. And like while like Bimbo, Antonio Banderas is hanging around and, or Himbo, excuse me. And in the end, like, they're like, oh yeah, he's just like his dad. Look at him. You know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. And so really they're just like shitting on his ass. And, so I don't know exactly if personally, I don't know if I exactly felt empowered by it. But I don't know also if that's the point of a feminist movie always, is always to feel empowered. I think because it's a farce and because it's so absurd, I don't know, I guess, if they're, like, what the, if I could, like, pick out, like, a message, I guess, but, yeah.
Well, I think that just, like you say, like, that it, like, that it at least gives the, like the, you know, you can kind of just base it like on the very basic, like, Bechdel test of like the two female characters talk to each other about something that wasn't related to men, which is kind of tough in this one. Cause there's a lot of that, over the course of the movie. But I also feel like, you know, past that it's, you know, each, even though we talked that, you know, that all, a lot of these characters are just like crazy, they do have like very distinct personalities. You know, it's like, it's not like they're the same four characters over and over again. You know, it's they seem to be like four like fully formed ideas or personalities for people. And that kind of, I feel like that kind of elevates it over any, you know, or at least puts it in the conversation of like a feminist movie, because it kind of gives, you know, the female characters involved, they're just given a lot more to do and a lot more to, you know, they just kind of have a lot of room to explore, compared to other roles. You know, if this was like a, you know, if this was like a Katharine Hepburn movie or something.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like, I think if I were to pull out like an overarching theme, it's like, I mean, it's called Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And I feel like the causes of those individual breakdowns are men in each respect. So, I don't know if like the conclusion, you know, what conclusions are to be drawn from that, but just like the overall picture of, or like the story being told of like, hey, here's like a bunch of different women and they're all being driven absolutely batshit by men. Like, yeah, of course, like that's, like awesome to have on screen, and definitely I think it qualifies as like being in the conversation. I just like, I feel like there's so much, or I feel like there are so many distinctions of like what makes a feminist movie that like I don't know what it is or what it's supposed to be, but like, yeah, I would say it definitely like is in the conversation.
I think that's kind of the interesting question to ask with this one, because I agree with you. It's not like, I don't think a feminist movie has to be like, I feel, you know, you're a woman, right, and you go, I feel right. empowered, you know, like, I don't think that's the only function. It's like, you know, that kind of almost a limit that's almost like sexist in the way right, that you're looking exactly. at that, because if you looked at like a comedy or a Western or something, you know, like that, it's like, well, it's a Western because of like, you know, A, B, C, and D. It's not just like A. And so I think that's kind of what's interesting about this one is it has like these, you know, they may be batshit crazy most of the movie, but they're also like complex, you know, characters. They're, you know, they have their good and their bad moments, and also are like, you know, trying to, you know, they're thinking through all of their issues, even though it may not be the right course of action.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with that.
What about you, Juliana?
I don't know. I feel like any kind of like trying to say, oh, this is a feminist movie, I mean, just kind of echoing like what you guys have said, because it meets A, B, and C like kind of qualities to it. I mean, it's definitely like undoubtedly like a female forward movie. Like the male characters who are in it are either like very much side characters or like literally not on screen for 90% of the movie, but also, you know, a lot of it is driven by like Ivan and trying to figure out this mystery and find out where he is and blah blah blah, and also these terrorists, which is a weird like kind of plot beat of the movie. I don't know. I think like the only thing I could really say on it is I couldn't say definitively like yes, it's a feminist film or no, it's not, but you can definitely analyze it through a feminist lens for sure.
Yeah. And the thing, you know, from my limited viewing of Almodovar films, is that he kind of likes to, like, he doesn't want to just be painted as, like, this is a feminist film. Like, he's constantly trying to kind of subvert and kind of play around with all that stuff, you know. It's like, I think of, you know, when it comes to LGBTQ plus any film with that as, like, the kind of core subject matter, it's, you know, I know that one, you know, trope that you see constantly is it's like it has to always be have like a sad ending, you know. It's like it has to you have to have you know, the main character committing suicide or something at the end. Like that's the way that you like, you know, gain the weight and gravitas to like, you know, handle that subject matter. And, you know, that's, it might be a little bit of a different example, but you know, you're just kind of like, why does that have to be the only functioning way that we engage with like that, you know, kind of like that group of people? Like I would say that, you know, a more, you know, rather than watching something like that, a more important LGBT movie would be something like The Birdcage by Mike Nichols, which very much is, you know, on the same wavelength as this movie. And it's just because it creates these, you know, complex, interesting characters who just have their own worlds, their own lives within the you know, the format of the movie. And you know, it's all about just kind of seeing, you know, somebody and, you know, living their life in the way that they kind of want to be explored. You know, I think that's like the way that you should be kind of gauging that, rather than just going, well, is it hitting like the, you know, identity chart that it's supposed to be hitting? So kind of looking at Almodovar, because one thing I mentioned at the end of the episode last week is that here on Cinematary, we have not really covered a lot of like Spanish language movies. And so I feel like Almodovar is a...
Woohoo!
Or Almodovar. I realize I've been saying it wrong the entire episode, guys.
You know.
Almodovar.
I think that you have a...
Whoops.
All of us have a solid track record of just butchering everything.
I'm white. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I know, and it's just like...
yeah, you're going to get a lot of angry...
We lost all of our Spanish language listeners, I'm sure. They're deep... That's fine. I'm used to it. But, you know, looking at Almodovar's work, especially, like, his work with Antonio Banderas, you know, this one movie I was thinking about in terms of this one, which is kind of like a completely different vibe because it's much more serious, is Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. Just because, like, you have these people kind of distilled to this, for the most part. I mean, there is, like, different locations happening. It's not like Rope where they're all in just the one location the entire time. But especially just that second half of the movie where they're all in the apartment just kind of engaging with, you know, crazy plot point after crazy plot point. It's almost seemed like a comedy version of Rope. Have y'all seen that one?
No, I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen that one.
But I feel like inside that, I feel like there's definitely a sort of genre of just like house hijinks movies, whether it's comedies or like drama or horror or whatever, where it's just like you're trapped inside of this very like kind of closed set and it's just like running around like from thing to thing and like everything is happening at once. Sort of like a little bit of a, like in this movie and in Clue, just sort of a yakety sack. Oh my God, the cops are at the door. Oh wait, now we're going over here and this woman is over here and just like sort of running around and,
yeah. I also felt there was sort of like a really obvious nod to, Rear Window. I guess like maybe sort of in the middle of the movie when, what's her name? The main one, Peppa. When Peppa's following the like wife or mother of Antonio Banderas back to her apartment in the crazy cab or whatever, and so she's sitting there and just sort of watching. And we get all of these shots of, like, what's going on in, like, the windows of the apartment. And so we get this, like, woman dancing in her underwear, which is, like, very on the nose. And then we get, like, this guy, like, wiping away a tear. So it's, like, and he's sort of, like, on a lower level. And the dancer is, like, sort of on an upper level. So it's, like, we're going from, like, the dancer in Rear Window to, like, Miss Lonely Hearts. And, like, the music that's playing in that moment I felt was, like, very referential to, like, a Hitchcock soundtrack.
Absolutely. It kind of had like a Bernard Herrmann vibe going.
Totally.
You know?
Rope's one of the ones I haven't seen, but I could totally feel the vibes there.
Yeah. Well, that's what it also, just in terms of Rope, like that one, because it's set in just like the one location, especially the second half of this movie, where, like we've been talking about, like you have these small little things, whether it's the gazpacho or the telephone, or you have like the chickens walking around. You like have like these small little touches that just make it a little bit out of the ordinary, that it's like you kind of are introduced to it. And then, he comes back and he brings it back, you know, whenever something's happening between characters, and you just kind of have like that small excitement of, oh, I forgot about that thing. And so like even with like the gazpacho, when she just like it's kind of almost a little bit to the side where she's like pouring a glass for herself, and then you go, oh yeah, I forgot that has the sleeping pills in it. It's just it's constantly kind of playing with those little nuggets that he has planted like throughout the apartment. Everything starts like cropping up as things starts to become more crazy, and that kind of happens in Rope as well, but on a much more serious level.
Yeah, that's like the when she gets in the cab. I think she gets in the cab three times, and the second time she's like crying and she's like, "Why don't you have eye drops?" Because he's like got everything, like the little magazines for rent, and then in the like final, like, kind of action of the movie when she gets the gazpacho thrown in her face. And, I mean, it's got, like, garlic in it and stuff. And he finally has the eye drops. And it's like, oh, here you go. And it's like, of course. You know, yeah. I feel like there are just so many things that, like...
It was really nice.
Just, like, click into place in a way that, like, I feel like kind of balances out, like, how chaotic and crazy all the characters are, that like there's almost like a rhythm of like the universe makes sense even though it's so over the top.
Yeah, exactly. It's just it's like it's a completely absurd universe, but at the same time it like it's like, oh, that makes sense though, like in the
of course, yeah,
in the course of what's happening on this movie, that makes a, you know, absolute sense.
Yeah. The only thing that really didn't make sense was how hot the phone repair boy was. Like, why? He had no right.
This movie just had a theme of just being like, yeah, there's gonna be like three men in this, and they're all just gonna be really hot. Just cause. Just for funsies.
I like also that he just like shows up and is immediately, you know,
knocked out,
poisoned with the sleeping pills.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He shows up to basically say, oh, the phone was broken this morning, to the police, and then immediately cast aside.
Yeah. Himbo.
Exactly. Part of a, yeah, somebody add this to their letterbox list of the himbo cinematic universe.
Any final thoughts on Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown before we wrap up?
It just reminded me that I need to see more of his movies, because I've had them on my list for quite a while, and I've just heard very good things.
Yeah, same. I know that, I think Criterion had a bunch of them, the Criterion Channel, a couple months ago, so I'm hoping they'll bring it back. No, I think they're gone now, but they did have, like, a bunch of his stuff, one of the director series things, so... Very cool. Juliana, did you have any closing thoughts on Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown?
Not really, other than you should watch it if you have not. Check it out for sure.
Absolutely. No, it was great. I really enjoyed it. And another great year of young critics watch old movies. We'll have the whole series on cinematary.com. So
is this the last one?
Yay!
The last one.
Oh no! It was a good run.
It was, but in a minute we're gonna talk. We'll announce the next series, so it'll be the next one we got. Next series we got is exciting, but yeah, it's always sad to finish young critics. We got all the episodes though. Cinematary.com. You can listen back to all of them. But this will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we list all the movies that we talked about in this episode. And like I mentioned at the top, we're gonna be doing our watch party on Sunday at 7 p.m. Go to cinematary.com/watchparty to get the instructions. But it should be a good time. We're going to be watching Snowpiercer. And after that, we will be doing watch parties for our Patreons. So thank you to our patrons. You can go to patreon.com/cinematary to join. Thank you, Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Hell Yes Small World, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Matthew Lingo, Pedro Seraphim, Ron Hayes, The Kittiest of Kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Like I said, we're going to be kicking off our new series next week, and we will be doing our director series. So, the first one up is the late Agnes Varda. And so we got 4 weeks of Agnes. We're going to be kicking it off with LaPointe Court. Be sure to, join in, because mainly it's going to be a bunch of French movies, and I am terrible at pronouncing French words, so.
Oh, I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's gonna be, and I'm terrible at pronouncing French words,
perfect.
And I'm also completely okay with offending the French, so.
So perfect.
It's gonna be it's a great combo. But yeah, we'll have the full series on cinematary.com. You can check out what we're gonna be watching, but be sure to join the Patreon, because since As most people know, if you've seen the Criterion box set, there are a lot of Agnes Varda movies. So we're going to try to catch up with some ones that we maybe are unable to get to on the Patreon page. And then if you're an Agnes Varda fan, we talked about Cleo from 5 to 7 a couple years ago as one of our Young Critics movies. So you can go back and listen to that one. But yeah, until next week, thank you guys for listening. We'll see you then.